This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We know that America's electric grid is aging. We've witnessed brownouts and blackouts in areas because of it. We also know that demand for electricity is rising and will continue to rise as the population increases and as new uses for electric power are invented. And we're also aware that earth scientists are blaming climate change on the burning of fossil fuels, some of which are used in the generation of electricity. Is it possible to balance increased demand for energy with the need to stave off any man-made contribution to global warming? Well, our guests this hour believe so and have written a book together about it. Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming is the work of Fred Krupp and Miriam Horn. Mr. Krupp is president of the Environmental Defense Fund. Ms. Horn is a journalist and director of the Smart Grid Initiative at the Environmental Defense Fund, and they both join us from studios in snowy New York City. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for coming in and not leaving us high and dry here with all the bad weather up there. Your book is coming out at a time when surveys tell us that the number of people in America who believe in global warming has declined precipitously, and yet we hear climatologists say that we've experienced a series of the warmest years on record, and we are witnessing violent, huge storms wreaking havoc on all over the world. There was an article in the Charlotte Observer here on Sunday about the impact we are already seeing in North Carolina of rising sea levels. So how do you explain this disconnect? The fact that people don't believe it.
There are more big storms. 9 out of the last 11 years have been the warmest years ever recorded. But a lot of people just don't have the time to study the issue. And many people take their cues on this issue from people they consider opinion leaders, politicians, elected officials. And the issue of energy in this country and climate change, environmental issues, has unfortunately become so polarized that there's almost a cultural divide between those who believe fervently and those who, don't believe that that humans are causing it, even if they might believe the planet is getting warmer and storms are becoming more frequent. What we've tried to do in our book, Mike, is something a little different, not set out to prove the case of global warming, but rather set out to prove the case that there's a new industrial revolution around the corner that's already beginning, and that whether or not you believe in global warming, America cannot afford to be left out.
Well, you have said, you just said it, that what is required is a second industrial revolution, as sweeping as that affected a century ago by the likes of Thomas Edison, Henry Ford, and John D. Rockefeller. Now, all of those people were private capitalists. And today, a lot of people look toward the government to finance projects that will lead to innovation and decrease our dependence on fossil fuel. So why aren't private capitalists, industrialists, major corporations, entrepreneurs stepping forward the way Edison, Ford, and others did over 100 years ago? Or are they?
In fact, there are tremendous private investors. Many of them we talk about in the book. Venture capitalists like John Doerr see this as the greatest moneymaker of the century, the greatest moneymaking opportunity. Energy is the biggest industry in the world. Our partners in the projects that we're working on around the country to deploy these clean energy technologies include companies like Cisco, Oracle, Microsoft, Intel, Google. Cisco's CEO will tell you that this new energy system is going to be 1,000 times bigger than the Internet in terms of a profit center for them. General Electric, Whirlpool, Walmart, the list is, in fact, very long of companies that are stepping up because they see China in particular rushing ahead to become the biggest manufacturer of solar technologies and wind technologies, and they want to secure America's global competitiveness going forward.
It would seem to me that if more people knew this, it would diffuse the argument that we can't afford to get off of gasoline, or that the government shouldn't get involved in this, or that there is no global warming. It would seem to me that people who feel that way would see the potential in this, monetarily speaking, and for the world economy and the nation's economy, and get on board, wouldn't they?
I think so, Mike. And you know what? I think that you hit the nail on the head when you referred back to Thomas Edison, and there was a New York Times journalist not too many weeks ago who talked about what would happen today if Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell were to come alive and see what's going on with telephones and the electric grid. And the author made the point that in the case of Alexander Graham Bell, he wouldn't recognize the telephone system. We have wireless phones, cell phones everywhere. We have the internet coursing through the many telephone lines very, very efficiently. And yet, if Thomas Edison were to wake up or arise, he would say, you know what, the electric grid looks exactly the same as it was. It's a not a smart system. And one of the reasons is in the telecommunications industry, the government has done just enough to open up the phone system to competition through the Telecommunications Act, and all sorts of innovations have occurred from the iPhone on down. In the electric industry, government, you know, continues to impose some nonsensical conditions on the industry. There isn't much competition. There are a bunch of monopolies. And as a result, while in telephones we have a central nervous system and we have that in the internet, there's no intelligence built into our electric grid, and that's causing massive inefficiencies and also stifles the innovation that would otherwise be possible.
About 3 to 5 years ago, we started hearing about opening up the grid to businesses and individuals who would either have their own power generating capacity through solar or their own generators or whatever, and they would then be able to feed the grid when they didn't need that power. And we did a couple of programs on this, and there was some talk about this happening in various parts of our state, and it hasn't happened. Is that because government has put up these walls that artificially restrict the flow of electricity?
Well, they're definitely, it's unfolding in different ways around the country, largely in response to how the market is structured. So while it may not be true in the Southeast, where we still have a very traditional electricity market, in places like Texas, where the electricity market is competitive all across the value chain, the wholesale market, the retail market, in fact, you see customers beginning to be able to play a huge role and actually make money by providing services to the grid. And that includes selling energy in that they're making in their from their rooftop solar panels. But it also includes selling what we call negawatts, selling reductions in their electricity demand at times when electricity is particularly valuable to the utilities. So, for instance, on a hot summer afternoon, when everyone's air conditioner is cranking, if the Texas grid is starting to reach its limit, it can offer to pay a premium price to people to take off demand that might be discretionary, like they can delay defrosting their refrigerator until that night. And people can actually earn money both for selling energy and for selling demand reductions.
So what is the role of government? What should the role of government be in either developing new energy sources and technologies or in opening up the grid or helping to develop a smart grid, which we'll talk about exactly what that is later on in the program? What should the role of government be in all this?
Well, one thing governments can do, and the city of Austin, Texas is doing, but also in Charlotte, North Carolina, we've got some good action happening, is governments can have a vision of a future where there is a smart grid, intelligence built into the grid, where efficiency is rewarded, and where entrepreneurs have incentives to bring the latest technologies. In Austin, Texas, the Chamber of Commerce, the University of Texas, IBM, GE, Oracle, Cisco, Microsoft are all involved. But in Charlotte, we've also got a good group, including Duke Energy and Cisco and Wells Fargo and the Environmental Defense Fund, all working to create the most environmentally sustainable urban core in the United States. And so one of the things governments can do is just help networks of organizations and companies get together to, in this case, in Charlotte, turn 60 of the uptown commercial buildings into real high-performing, energy-efficient buildings. Another thing governments can do is have the public utilities commissions create the conditions that reward efficiency and make sure that when smart grid investments are made, they do add intelligence to the system and they do bring down costs for consumers and make everything more efficient. Another thing governments can do, Mike, the last thing I'll mention here, is when utilities need regulatory approvals, like right now Duke Energy proposes to merge with Progress, governments can make sure that when they consider that merger, the advantages of new technologies and energy efficient investments are built into their consideration. So at the back end, we come out with stronger performance, more efficient use of electricity, better technologies.
You talked about incentives throughout that last part of our conversation. And if it's true, as you say, that new fortunes will be made that will dwarf the mega fortunes of the information technology revolution, isn't that incentive enough for small business, for big business, for individuals to get involved in developing technologies and working toward a smarter grid system? Just the fact that riches abound out there if you're the first to get there.
Well, only if you give people access to the market. So if, for instance, in California, when Pacific Gas and Electric, one of the big utilities out there, they spent a lot of money, not investor money, but customer money, installing smart meters throughout their network. But they did not do the critical second step, which is to then pass through the data that was coming from those meters to customers and make it possible for energy service companies, the Facebooks and YouTube of energy that are waiting to be created and that are emerging, did not make it possible for those guys to get into the market. So if we open up market access and if we fairly assess costs and benefits of various technologies, one of the other things that government can do is in both Austin and Charlotte, the community has decided they are going to set themselves some very ambitious targets to clean up their own air. They know that having cleaner air makes a big difference in terms of attracting business and residents and creating jobs and having good public health and good quality of life. So in Charlotte, they have committed in 5 years to reduce energy use and air pollution 20%. And in Austin, they've committed to reduce air pollution 65%, including global warming pollution. So if you really are fairly crediting what energy is delivering you, then that market will be enormous for those companies. But right now, the market is skewed against them.
That program that you keep talking about in Charlotte, I believe, is called Envision Charlotte. And
yes,
believe it or not, I don't think it's very well known in our city. It seems to be taking place in the uptown core, and it's with major corporations and, as you said, I think 60 office buildings? That it's involved in. Probably the people involved in those office buildings, in those companies there, know about it. And I think we've talked about it peripherally on this program, but it's not very well publicized. Would it be helpful if it were?
It's a pretty new program. It was just the commitment was made at the last Clinton Global Initiative meeting by Duke and Cisco and Wells Fargo. So we're really just getting rolling. Fred and I are actually traveling to Charlotte tomorrow, and I'm going to be meeting with the Duke team that's working on the project to really get it rolling.
That's Miriam Horn, who's director of the Smart Grid Initiative at the Environmental Defense Fund, along with Fred Krupp, who's the president and has been for a very long time of the Environmental Defense Fund. We're talking about their book, and among the other things, their book's called Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming, and we will continue our conversation in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte presenting The Graduate. A recent college graduate has an affair with an older married woman and then falls for her daughter January 21st to February 6th. Tickets at carolinatix.org. Well, the snow that we had recently has almost all melted, and if you're a gardener, that's good and bad news. Bad news because the snow may have taken its toll on some of your plants. Good because you have plenty to do between now and spring to get ready for the growing season and to help out. We have invited Nancy Bracci to join us. She's the garden writer for the Charlotte Observer, along with a cooperative extension agent, to talk about the important things that you can do now and, in fact, every month of the year to make your garden grow. That's all tomorrow at 9. Thank you.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a recent poll shows Americans tend to believe all major political groups go too far in using inflammatory language. We invite you to share ideas on how to encourage civility in our public debates.
That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Fred Krupp, who's the president of the Environmental Defense Fund, and Miriam Horn, the Smart Grid Initiative Director at that fund, about alternative sources of energy and about making working toward a smart grid and innovating in the world of energy. As Miriam mentioned a second ago, she's coming to Charlotte tomorrow, and Fred is coming to the area as well, and he'll be speaking Thursday at 6 p.m. At the Keppel Auditorium at Catawba College in Salisbury about what we're talking about this morning. In your book, Earth, the sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming, you talk a lot about people who are out there, even as we speak, doing some remarkable things. And I'd like to talk about some of those people here as we go through the program. Individuals who are involved in energy innovation, and they include scientists at a California-based company who have found an inexpensive substitute for solar panels, which tend to be fairly costly. Tell us more about that effort.
Well, one of the scientists that we profile is Conrad Burke, who has figured out a way to take sand, unrefined silicon, grind it up and mix it in a paint. And it turns out that the paint can convert the sun's light into electricity. Originally, his plan was to just paint this onto any material, including rooftops, to create very inexpensive solar panels. It turns out that very recently, since the book came out even, he's figured out that if you take expensive solar panels, which have now been coming way, way down in price over the last couple of years, and apply a layer of his paint to those panels, you can boost their efficiency by as much as a percent or a percent and a half, giving them efficiencies instead of, say, 17 or 18% of 18 or 19%. That sounds like a little, but it's an enormous increase in the amount of electricity that can come from a panel. And he signed some huge contracts with the world's biggest makers of solar panels.
Is this expensive? In other words, if you wanted to take your roof and paint it with this special paint, and then I don't know how you'd hook it up to the grid, but but you'd hook it up, would you be generating enough electricity to run the house on a sunny day?
Well, right now there are what Fred is describing is called thin film solar, where you make solar on thin, flexible films. And there are companies that are manufacturing that at commercial scale. And as Fred mentioned, the price of solar has dropped spectacularly over the last couple years. And the reason is because the Chinese have jumped in a major way. They are now the world's biggest manufacturer of solar panels. So they've brought, in fact, the price of solar down. The magic number everyone always talks about is $1 a watt that makes solar electricity competitive in even cheap coal markets, makes it competitive with retail electricity. And the Chinese have actually pushed the price down now. So what you wouldn't be buying is this kind of paint because, as you note, you need to have wires to transmit the electricity you create into your home. But you could go out on the market now and buy extremely cheap solar panels, whether thin film panels or the ones you're more accustomed to that are in glass and aluminum. But the odds are they will have been manufactured in China.
And how much cheaper are we talking? Because, you know, we've done some shows here as well on solar panels, and sometimes, I mean, they'll set you back five figures to run a house, it seems to me. So are we getting to a point where people can really look at this and say, I can afford that?
Yeah, the cost of the solar panels, Mike, just in the last 12 months has come down about 30%. And if you go back past 18 months, it's come down about 40%. So this is a big price drop. The Chinese government sees a future of this new industrial revolution, and they are being very supportive of companies that are getting into it, so much so that our government has filed an unfair trade practices proceeding, or the, I should say that the AFL-CIO has filed an unfair trade practices proceeding on this, and then I guess our government did as well. But the at the same time, American companies like Evergreen Solar, based in Massachusetts, which had grown very fast and emerged as America's third biggest producer of solar cells, just announced within the last week that they're going to lay off 800 employees, and they're moving their production facilities to China because there's access to much cheaper loans, you know, in China. So, again, this is an area where while private entrepreneurs have been working hard to get America with it, we do need some different government policies here if we're going to be competitive
with
China.
How many other electrical generation innovations could be co-opted by lower labor costs outside the country and so therefore will not be job producers?
Well, already the Chinese are the biggest manufacturers in the world of both solar photovoltaics and wind turbines, which are the two that will, going forward, have the biggest capacity in the world. The other areas that people are working on are geothermal energy, using the heat in the earth to make electricity, and wave energy, using the either tidal flows or the crashing power of the waves to make electricity. As yet, the Chinese haven't taken over those technologies, but the wave technology in particular is still in its infancy. The ocean turns out to be a very difficult place to work. and geothermal technology has actually been exploited for a very long time all over the world. We do write about a very inventive character from Alaska.
Bernie,
yes. Who figured out how to use water, hot water coming out of the earth that was cooler than anyone had ever used before, and put it to the rather unusual use of using it to refrigerate an ice hotel up at his resort in Alaska. So he remains probably the most innovative guy out there on geothermal. We do still have tremendous innovation resources here if we set them loose.
Let's talk about Bernie for a second, because I don't have your book, and I just was reading through some highlights of it. And this guy, there's a connection to Charlotte here with Bernie, because Carrier, who is based in Charlotte, has taken some off-the-shelf parts that they use for air conditioning and helped him to harness this power, this geothermal power, both for refrigeration purposes as well as for generating electricity. But it takes a lot of money. This guy must be really wealthy. Is he wealthy?
Oh, no. Bernie, I got to go up to Bernie's resort, which looks like a kind of Sanford and Sons film set. It is a ramshackle place. Bernie has been, his main source of income for about 30 years was K&K Recycling. He's basically a junk man. He likes going out and salvaging junk and putting it together in new ways.
But he invests hundreds of thousands of dollars and sometimes loses it. How can he afford to do that?
Well, he bets everything on the farm, as his wife would tell you in an instant, and has lost everything on the farm a few times. He did also, as you mentioned, he managed to get one of the biggest corporations in the world to partner with him. He's this little tiny country mouse, and he got Carrier, which is part of United Technologies Corporation, as well as a number of their other divisions. So some of the financial risk they were able to take on. But he has managed to really, with spit and glue, put his projects together year after year after year.
And he's done things that experts would say you cannot do. He just thought the experts only know what you can't do. They don't know what you can do. And so he's flown in the face of convention and been successful. He has, as you say, this ice hotel. And you would think Alaska's a perfect place for that because it's cold. But it's not cold in the summertime when the sun never goes down. And it kept melting, and he was going to lose his investment. So he found a way to harness the source of geothermal energy from underground and use heat to make cold. Talk about that.
Well, it's called an absorption chiller. It's actually a familiar technology. Anytime you have a big source of energy like heat and you have a big temperature differential, like between the hot underground springs and the cold creek water, you can make energy from that and use that energy to chill things. As I mentioned, what Bernie did that the experts said he couldn't do was use water that really isn't that hot. And the way he did it is he found this incredible engineer named Gwen, a young woman who had moved to Alaska to study astrophysics and was an engineer and was also a dog musher. She has finished the Iditarod, the 1,000-mile race in the Alaska night, a number of times. And Gwen and another couple engineers figured out how to do this. And then Bernie got UTC to come in, United Technologies to come in and help him turn it into a commercial product.
Now, he also uses geothermal energy to generate electricity. How abundant is geothermal energy in this country and around the world?
It's enormously abundant. The U.S. DOE estimates that we could make about 20% of all the electricity we need from geothermal resources. There are pockets wherever there's mountains, where there's volcanoes.
Geysers.
You're in a good geothermal resource. There are also people who want to drill into the ground and tap the heat, even in places where it's not already bubbling up to the surface.
So are there reasons that we're not doing this? Is it cost? Is it the same kind of objection that we sometimes get to wind farms, that they supposedly damage the view, etc.?
It's really been so far that we ensured that coal remained so cheap, and in large measure because we gave them this huge subsidy of allowing them to freely pollute the atmosphere, that there just wasn't really a competitive landscape. I mean, there are places like the geysers in California that have been making geothermal energy for 30 years, but in most of the country, it's been this unfair subsidy for coal electricity that has kept a lot of these things under wraps.
Is that changing?
Well, I think it is changing, Mike. I think we're coming to understand that the Environmental Protection Agency and its regulations and keeping things clean for people's health can have enormous economic benefits for the country. So let me give you an example. You mentioned China's strength a little while ago in terms of inexpensive labor rates and how that makes it hard for America and Americans to compete. And that's true. That's one of China's strengths. But America has strengths, too. We have the advantage of being very entrepreneurial and very innovative. So when EPA has demanded that companies produce diesel engines that are cleaner, we've seen both Cummins Engine and Caterpillar, two great American companies, emerge with cleaner diesel engines for trucks. We're now exporting these trucks to China. It's one of America's great exports. These companies have been very profitable. Their stock prices have gone up because the Environmental Protection Agency said we have to have cleaner trucks. And because of that, America's been in the lead in producing the cleaner engines that everyone around the world wants. In North Carolina, there's the Cree company, which makes LED lighting, which was exporting LED lights to China for the Olympics. These are the lights, Miriam tells me, that helped light up the bird's nest that you remember from watching the Olympic stadium. So, that's a North Carolina example of, while sure China has disadvantages, instead of whining about it, we need to play to our strengths, and our strengths have been innovation. Now, we will need to make sure that the government sets up the conditions, like requiring that any form of electricity be clean. And once there's a level playing field, these technologies, we can make them in the USA and export them elsewhere instead of lagging behind others in the world who are going to the clean electric sources of the future.
I don't want to dwell too much on Bernie here up in Alaska, but when I read about Bernie, he reminded me, at least in my, and this may be a false connection, but he reminded me of Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell, who to me, they made money at what they did, I suppose, but I don't think that they invented the phonograph or the telephone or the light bulb or the movie camera necessarily just to make money. They did it, I think, to make the world a better place. And Bernie has become a test ground for future technologies, and he has taken a kind of he's barred from the software industry. He's taken an open source approach to his inventions, because you say that he believes that none of his inventions or innovations are proprietary and that they should be widely shared. Is that what it's going to take to make some of these new technologies catch on, freely distribute them?
That's a really good question. The companies that we've mentioned before, like Cisco and Honeywell and Intel, who see this enormous opportunity, also see that, like the Internet, there's going to have to be a tremendous level of interoperability and fundamentally a network that is open and flexible enough that they will all be able to step in. But I think, like the Internet, you'll still see the opportunity to make enormous fortunes. Google was able to make an enormous amount of money, is still making enormous money, with a platform that everybody can use to build on, but Google still found a way to make a profit from it. So I think you want that kind of openness that still enables companies to get rich.
There's another company that you write about that is re-engineering yeast so that it can create hydrocarbon fuels virtually identical to jet fuel and diesel and gasoline. But these fuels, it seems to me, are still hydrocarbon fuels. So what is the benefit, aside from getting ourselves off foreign oil?
Well, actually, they are carbon-based molecules, but not from fossil fuels. They're made from plants and from sugars that come from plants. So they do help us get off of fossil fuels to the extent that the price of those fuels, the newer fuels, can be competitive. So the company you're talking about is Amyris. One of the inventors who I've had the chance to meet is Jack Newman. There's three PhD biologists who came up with a yeast that was bioengineered basically to turn sugars into whatever fuel was desirable, whether that's diesel fuel, gasoline, or jet fuel. They still have a ways to go, Mike, to bringing the price down, but they've just had an initial public offering and raised tens of millions of dollars to keep their research going.
But I guess the question I'm asking here is that if they are successful and we start filling our tanks with this yeast-based fuel, will we still be contributing to climate change, to global warming, to pollution?
Well, the idea is that the plants take the carbon out of the atmosphere, and yes, when it's burned, it's released back.
So it's carbon neutral?
So it's carbon neutral, done well, done right, and that compares rather favorably with burning gasoline or jet fuel made from oil, because you're taking oil that was stored underground, you know, millions of years ago, and when you burn it, that's a net addition to the atmosphere. So yes, these are positive fuels.
Where are they? And I know they're just getting started with the initial public offerings and things like that, but how far down the road do you think this is from any kind of significant contribution to our energy needs?
They're in Brazil. They've done Brazil, which has, as you know, a huge sugar resource. Mm-hmm. They've got a joint venture going there, and they're already making, I believe they're up to the hundreds of thousands of gallons level now.
Okay.
So they're at a commercial scale. They're not yet able to do that in the U.S.
We have to take a break. Miriam Horn is the last voice you heard. Fred Krupp is also with us, both with the Environmental Defense Fund. We'll continue in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Levine JCC, now offering tours and membership to its Family Fitness Center at 5007 Providence Road. Swim, tennis, yoga, Pilates, personal training, and more. Details, charlottejcc.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, encouraging civility in political debates. A recent poll shows Americans tend to believe all major political groups go too far in using inflammatory language. Diane invites you to share ideas on how to encourage civility in our public debates. If you'd like to join our conversation, now's the time. 704-926-WFAE. That's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. And by the way, our guest Fred Krupp will be in town Thursday evening at 6 at Keppel Auditorium at Catawba College, talking about his book and what we're talking about this morning.
Patrick George, owner of Heartwood Tree Service in Charlotte, a WFAE underwriter.
If your business is more than just a commodity, then you're going to find people that are searching for quality. You know, I am absolutely proud to be a supporter of the information that goes out to the community and to the asset that it is to our community.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. For more information, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Fred Krupp, president of the Environmental Defense Fund, Miriam Horn, a journalist and director of the Smart Grid Initiative at the Environmental Defense Fund. Together, they have written a book called Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming. And we're talking about some of the things in that book and some of the ideas that both of them have been working on over the last many years, because Mr. Krupp has been head of the Environmental Defense Fund for 26 years, if I'm right about the number there. Let's take a
you
couple.
You are indeed.
Okay, well, we'll take a couple of phone calls here, and then we'll I'll move on with some more questions that I may have here. Lawrence in Charlotte, welcome. You're on WFAE.
Hey, thanks, Mike. You need to keep up with these programs. They're just fantastic. I had originally said I had one question, but actually I have two.
Okay.
The first one is that I'm still continuously burned by the fact that there was an article in the local newspaper that said that they would not replace the lights that the wire was stolen out of them on Brookshire Freeway with solar because they would only save $1 million. That's the first thing. The second thing is they're talking about China and the wind turbines. And I read an article several weeks ago about a company that had actually invested a lot of money in wind turbine production in China, and they stole their technology, and now they are still producing those wind turbines that were, you know, the technology was stolen, but the company has actually doubled its profits. So it's not pursuing any actions against China. And I know this is a problem with a lot of the other companies that are trying to invest in China. And I wanted wanted your guests to comment on them.
Yeah, China has a tough time with intellectual property rights and honoring those. Is that going to be an ongoing problem in this sector?
Well, I know that's something that the president and Hu Jintao, the president of China, are going to be talking about as they get together today and tomorrow in Washington. And it's a serious issue, and I wouldn't minimize it. It's one of our challenges, and it rises to the level where presidents talk to each other about it. On the caller's first question, the idea that solar paneled powered lights can in some instances save money. I think that's a very good point. I can't comment specifically on the wires being stolen in Charlotte, but I can say that in many areas around the country now, there is starting to be are starting to replace not only traffic lights, but more recently street lights with very efficient LED lamps, so that these use just a fraction of what the old street lights used, and it's a way that we can make our lights on our roads that we're all paying for a lot less costly. Mm-hmm. So another opportunity to save money, and I'm not up to date as to whether they've started to install them yet in Charlotte, but it's something that around the country you're just beginning to see a move into street lights that are much more efficient.
Lawrence, thank you for your call.
Thank you, Mike.
The situation he was referring to is there's an inner city freeway that circles the downtown area, and the copper wiring had been stolen. they would rewire the lights, the lights that light up the pavement at night, and they would go out, and it's because they are stealing the wires. And so in the good times, saving $1 million didn't seem like a lot of money. Now I guess it would, but there's probably not $1 million to put them in. Let's go to Nancy in Norwood. Welcome to the program, Nancy.
Yes, hi, Mike.
Hi.
I'm really excited about their being here at Catawba College. I wanted to share briefly that we've just installed a photovoltaic solar panel array on our barn with Southern Energy Management out of Raleigh and Charlotte. And one of the interesting things is here in Stanley County, there's a company that is actually making the framing for SEM, Southern Energy Management, and we probably are thereby using local products. I'm so excited about that.
Have you saved any money yet, or do you know?
Oh, absolutely. In 5 years, we're going to pay, have the whole thing paid off because we're a farm. And so we're considered, I think, a commercial or something like that rather than residential. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that, I've been running. I'm out of breath. We're paying Duke 11 cents for our per kilowatt hour for our electricity. Mm-hmm. And then all of the electricity that is produced on the barn, which is a 5.12 kilowatt array, is being, we're being paid for 21 cents per kilowatt hour. So the electricity is going out to Duke and Advanced Energy, the nonprofit that's promoting green energy sources. Mm-hmm. And we, thereby ours, are North Carolina Green Power Source, and we're excited about that. So we're being paid for the electricity, in essence, and it's going to be paid off in 5 years. So we're just, it's a win-win-win-win.
I would say so. Nancy, thank you for your call. Is it normal for a utility company to that charges 11 cents a kilowatt hour to pay 21 cents for somebody's power that they're generating from their solar array? Is that common around the country?
Well, that's called a feed-in tariff, mm-hmm. and it's been used very successfully in Europe to promote, it really propelled Germany to a leading position in solar generation, and mm-hmm. Spain as well. So it's in use in a few places around the country. The thing that I find most exciting about that story is that it's a local company that is in fact earning money and able to hire local people. And a lot of communities, that is one of their primary motivations. We have a website, lesscarbonmorejobs.org, where you can actually look state by state at maps, including North Carolina, and see those companies that are growing thanks to this clean energy revolution and creating local jobs. You also keep dollars at home. In Austin, where we work, Texas, a big motivation is to quit shipping their local money out to power companies outside of Austin and outside of Texas and keep those dollars at home making their own homegrown energy.
Frank writes, you commented on the Massachusetts closing of the Evergreen solar plant laying off 800 workers. The state of Massachusetts invested $58 million in this facility, the largest amount in a private company. Evergreen blamed the closing on competition from subsidized Chinese manufacturers. Do you still advocate government subsidies in light of what happened in Massachusetts?
Well, that's a really good question. I think the government can have a role in providing lower cost interest loans. I think that when we get the rules right, when we require all energy to be clean, that the need for subsidies diminishes, and that the most important thing, the most explosive thing government can do, the highest leverage thing government can do, is set up this level playing field where energy going forward is going to have to be clean. It turns out that that alone has enormous economic benefits. As the EPA rules have gone into effect since 1990 when the Clean Air Act was revised, we have over $30 of economic benefits and lower health costs for every $1 that's had to be spent cleaning up the air. So there's a lot of different benefits on the public health side and economic side, and just requiring generation to be clean is, mm-hmm. I think, more important than the subsidies.
There's so many issues here. There's the environment. There is the need to get off foreign oil. There is a way here to revive the economy, to create jobs. Which is the more important factor, do you think, in spurring innovation? Which of those, and there are probably others that I left off the table here.
I think right now our country really needs jobs, and I think we are going to be missing out unless at the state level, at the local level, and at the national level, we really get with it. We say to our elected officials that on this issue, which is so important to America, we've got to rise above the bickering and the partisanship and the dysfunctionality and come together and create those minimal governmental policies that unleash entrepreneurs to create the new energy that the whole world is demanding. Mm-hmm. So I would say that is extremely important. At the same time, Mike, I don't want to minimize the opportunity here to really clean up the air. our power companies continue to be big sources of air pollution, which has very bad effects on people and people's lungs. We still have in this country over 140 completely uncontrolled power plants burning coal, and a very aging electric utility sector. So there's an opportunity to clean up our air and make us all healthier, give us longer sight lines, too, as the air becomes cleaner and more transparent. That's also important.
And one of those innovations is happening right now, evidently, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. They're working on feeding, carbon dioxide from a power plant smokestack to algae. And the algae then turns this stuff into biodiesel fuel. Is that another carbon-neutral situation, or is that carbon-negative?
it's actually still a carbon-positive, but
okay.
Because the algae, you're taking this carbon that's been buried deep in the earth, and you're feeding it to the algae. When you turn them into biofuel and burn the fuel, the carbon does end up in the atmosphere. The advantage is you've gotten two times use. You've run it through mm-hmm. the system twice instead of once. There have been experiments like that around the country. The scientist that you're mentioning who was at MIT managed to do a scale experiment in Arizona with a big power plant down there. That no one has quite made the economics of that work yet. And with any time that you're engaged in biofuels, and this is certainly true in the Southeast, there's always calculations to be made about impacts on land and water that have to be taken into account.
I know that you're an expert, Miriam, on the smart grid. And people, we've talked about this before, the smart grid. But can you define what exactly that means? Is it like an internet? Is it like being able to turn off your heat using an app on an iPhone, but it's more sophisticated than that? Is that essentially what it is? A two-way
yep.
communication grid?
Yep, exactly. It's putting intelligence into the system all the way from the power plant or the wind turbine, which can run more efficiently, through the power lines where you can now avoid blackouts, you can island problems, you can manage the power flowing on those lines much more efficiently, down through the substation where, again, you can create a lot more reliability and you can move power from where it's being made to where it needs to go. All the way down into the home where you can have the kind of app you're describing where if you decide to go out to dinner, you can tell your water heater not to bother kicking on till 10 o'clock because you're not going to be home to take a shower.
Where are we on making that a reality? How far away is that? Are we at the beginning stages? Have we not begun? Are we halfway through? Where are we?
We're actually getting there in parts of the country. We are getting the brains into the system. Texas and California are leading, largely because both of the opportunity for competition and because of state policies that are driving that.
Well, in California, law requires that the state get 33% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020, and that requires a new grid, or they'll have brownouts and blackouts out there. Is that the kind of legislation that you're talking about that will help drive this?
Yes, because wind and solar come and go, as you know. Mm-hmm. If you have a smart grid, when the wind dies down, you can turn down those defrosters in the freezers or you can dim the lights. And when the wind picks back up, you can kick those energy users back into action as well.
And how urgent is this? Because now, you know, General Motors and Nissan are rolling out these plug-in electric vehicles. Every day there's a new gadget that you plug into the wall to charge. We are becoming more and more, we got more and more stuff hooked up to the electric grid. Is it becoming urgent that we develop the smart grid?
I think, Mike, it's a huge opportunity. When we talked earlier in the show about energy independence and weaning America off of oil, the fact that Nissan is coming out with a Leaf, that GM is coming out with a Volt, that Toyota is coming out with a plug-in hybrids mean that we're going to start to power our cars in this country with electricity, but everyone knows one of the limiting factors there is batteries, that batteries remain expensive. So with a smart grid, we can take power generated in the night when the nuclear power plants in South and North Carolina run day and night with really no extra cost, and use that energy to charge up a battery or solar energy at the time when the sun is shining and we have extra, or when the wind is blowing often at night, We can use the extra energy at night from whatever source and store it in the batteries that people are going to be buying anyway in these cars, and that can help us use less oil. At the same time, we have to make sure that the energy is generated, you know, cleanly, so we're not exacerbating the air pollution problem we have.
And Miriam, you've described the rollout of some of these new technologies as being clumsy and as a result have been greeted with skepticism and hostility. How do you change that?
Well, again, that's really the role of the Public Utility Commissions is to make sure that the utilities take seriously their responsibility. It is the customers that are paying for this new infrastructure. It gets built into their rates, and it is the customers, therefore, who should get the benefits. And that includes greater reliability and saving money and cleaner air.
Do we have an energy policy in this country, per se?
Not yet, but we need to work on that, and we need to do whatever we can right in North Carolina and the other states to at least have the states have energy policies that make sense.
Fred Krupp, president of the Environmental Defense Fund, Miriam Horn, the director of the Smart Grid Initiative for the Environmental Defense Fund. Together, they've written a book called Earth, the Sequel, The Race to Reinvent Energy and Stop Global Warming, one that one reviewer said 20 years from now, some 35-year-old is going to say the reason he's a billionaire is that he read your book when he was 15. That's pretty exciting stuff. Thank you very much for the hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins.